Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward and director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Diane is visiting Interlochen Public Radio in Traverse City, Michigan. Well, Monday's disaster at a West Virginia coal mine ends what had been a trend of improved safety conditions at American coal mines. Later today, rescuers hope to resume efforts to save the trapped miners. Joining me in the studio to discuss how mine safety has progressed and what issues remain, Bruce Watzman with the National Mining Association, Dennis O'Dell from the United Mine Workers of America, and Gardner Harris with the New York Times. Joining us from WXXI's studio in Rochester, New York, is Ellen Smith of Mine Safety and Health News. But to start us off, and joining us now from the site of the accident, is NPR correspondent Brian Naylor. Brian, how are you, and what's the latest on the rescue efforts there?
Good morning, Frank. First, I should say I'm in Charleston, about 30 miles as the crow flies from the mine site itself. It's very hard to communicate from where the mine is, and so we've been filing from here. The latest this morning is that rescuers were able to drill a ventilation hole into the Upper Big Creek mine and tried to bang on the drill pipe in hopes that the four miners whose fate is still unknown might respond. They didn't get a response, and officials are talking about it's going to take a miracle for the four to have survived the blast.
So what's ahead for the rest of the day then? What is the trajectory this is on?
Well, they're going to set off some small explosions on the surface above the mine in hopes that would create a seismic signal and the miners might respond to that. And they've got to continue drilling. They want to drill a total of four holes in order to release the methane and carbon monoxide gases that built up inside the mine and forced rescuers to evacuate Monday. And when that process is complete, the rescuers can re-enter the mine. It's hoped over the next couple of days and continue their search for the four missing miners.
Brian, what is the thought in terms of these missing miners and whether they may have had access to one of these chambers that we've heard about?
Well, that's what rescuers, Governor Manchin this morning mentioned. That's what they're putting their hopes on. That after the blast at the Sago mine in West Virginia in 2006, rules went into effect ordering these safety chambers to be built inside these mines, so that if a miner survives the initial blast, they can find they're supposed to be airtight. They have air masks inside them and food supplies, and it's hoped that they might have found some refuge in there, and there are enough supplies to last for a couple of days. So that's what they're pinning their hopes on.
And it's believed they were near a chamber anyway when this went off.
That's right.
Now, how's the community reacting, Brian?
Well, you know, throughout the area, there are just lots and lots of mines and small towns in southern West Virginia, and you know, you drive around and you see a lot of signs in front of churches and in front of carryouts that say, "Pray for our miners." And I think, you know, there's a lot of that. It's a very close-knit community, and this is not the first time, obviously, that they've had to deal with this kind of a disaster. But there's also this kind of, you know, acceptance that, well, this is a way of life here. Coal is a way of life, and people are used to that. That's not to say that they're not angry. That's not to say that they don't blame the mine operator, Massey Energy Company, for allowing perhaps unsafe practices to go on at the mine. The community has kind of, it's a tight-knit community, and they've kind of come together as a big family, waiting to hear about the fate of these miners.
Brian Naylor is a correspondent for NPR. Thanks for joining us, Brian. Good luck today.
Thanks, Frank.
Well, joining us here in the studio for our discussion at this end is Gardner Harris, science reporter for the New York Times, and author of a book called Hazard, which happens to be set in a mine, right, Gardner?
It is.
Yeah. Bruce Watzman, he's Vice President, Health and Human Resources with the National Mining Association. Bruce, good day to you. And Dennis O'Dell, he's Safety Administrator for the United Mine Workers Union of America. And Ellen Smith, owner and managing editor of Mine Safety and Health News. She's joining us from WXXI in Rochester, New York. Dennis O'Dell, let me start with you from the perspective of the United Mine Workers of America. What are you hearing today? Anything different than what Brian was reporting?
No, we pretty much heard the same thing, that the rescue event itself has been brought to a halt as far as exploration underground. They're continuing to drill from the surface in hopes that they can remove the poisonous gases from underground. We understand from the information given to us by the authorities that all the ventilation controls underground were destroyed. So the only way to actually remove those gases from the mine at this point is to drill boreholes in hopes that a natural ventilation will occur that will draw them out to the surface so that the mine rescue teams can go back underground in a safe atmosphere.
Big explosion, Bruce Watzman, from everything we've heard. What sets something like that off?
Well, there can be the one of two sources. There are two fuel sources underground. One is methane gas, the other is coal dust. And there needs to be an ignition source. We don't know what caused the explosion at this point, what the ignition source was, and then you have the two fuel sources. And that's what the investigation will tell us and we'll all learn from.
Ellen Smith, the headline in the front page of the Washington Post today, across the front page, mine cited for a litany of safety violations, and among the bullet points, 1,342 citations for safety violations since the beginning of 2005. What's the safety record of this mine?
Well, the safety record of this mine in 2009 was troubling, and that's the 438 citations. But more than the citations, it's the what we call 104D2 orders, and those were unwarrantable failure. It's more than ordinary negligence. It's an elevated enforcement action that the government can take, and 48 is quite a bit. And if you look at other mines that are similar size with, 200 miners underground or more, you just don't see that many 104D2 orders at other operations. Now, that said, other Massey mines that I've looked at have far better records. And again, you can't look at the overall citations. It's an indication, but if a mechanic leaves a pile of rags in a travel way, they can get cited for that. You have to really look at the citations themselves.
Well, let me ask you about one aspect of the citations.
Sure.
Inspectors cited operators more than 100 times in the first quarter of 2010 alone, but including, and this is the term I want to ask you about, 6 times for unwarrantable failure to correct
right.
violations. What's that
exactly
mean?
That's the elevated enforcement action. MSHA found more than ordinary negligence. It means that the operator was cited previously. This condition wasn't corrected. And they will withdraw miners, if it's an order, from one section of the mine or from the entire mine. And there have been 18 orders at this mine since September 16th. That's as far back as I could go on a short notice. There are some definitely troubling aspects here. There's ventilation violations. There's roof control violations. They've been having trouble with aligning their conveyor belt. They received two huge fines in January, one for $70,000 and one for $66,000. For alleged ventilation violations, and they are contesting those fines. There were orders there, and MSHA has been at this mine. There has been a continuing presence of MSHA inspectors at this mine.
We have more than 24 miners dead, and these 4 whom are still being sought. And I'm hearing you talk about this litany of issues, including these recent ones and this unwarrantable failure to correct violations. Can anybody explain, Ellen, and those of you in the studio, how this works? I mean, this has to be puzzling for people. If you're working at a meatpacking plant or an auto safety or an auto assembly plant, the line would be shut down, presumably, with this kind of parade of violations. Gardner?
Yeah, I mean, look, Ellen knows this stuff incredibly well. She's been doing this for years and years and years. I lived in Hazard for a long time. And you get to a point where you just cannot believe this continues to go on, right? I mean, there are a lot of dangerous industries out there. Why is it that coal mining continues to have disasters? And it's and there's sort of a symbiotic relationship, I think, between the companies who behave badly and the workers who let it happen. And there is
The workers who let it happen?
Yes, they do. I'm sorry, they do. Yeah, I lived there for a long time, but there are a lot of guys who go underground and they know these are unsafe conditions. It doesn't happen as often in union mines, but it happens all the time in non-union mines. And it's because the men have fewer, you know, choices, because many of them are uneducated, and because in Appalachia there is this sense that they want to stay. It is a very immobile place, and if they want to stay, then they have to work underground.
Bruce Watzman, from the point of view of the industry, what's your response to
that? I have to take exception, and understandably, you'd expect that with Gardner. I don't think there's a mentality like that it's an accepted practice to violate the law, and that's basically what Gardner is saying.
But what is your response to my question and to Ellen's observation about all these violations, citations, unwarrantable failure to correct, that still allows this mine to be operating?
Well, I think that, you know, you talk about the sheer magnitude of the number of violations, and I think in the public's mind, it's hard for them to understand what a violation means in mining, and they equate it to their everyday life. If you got 400 moving violations while driving a vehicle, you'd expect one to have lost their license. But if 390 of those were parking violations and 10 were moving violations, it would be entirely different. We have gradients in the citation scheme in the mining industry, and you have to look at the whole picture.
We'll have more on that whole picture, what went wrong and what can be done about it, on the Diane Rehm Show when we continue. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane. Today we're talking about the mining disaster that's unfolding as we speak with Gardner Harris, science reporter for the New York Times, Bruce Watzman, Vice President, Health and Human Resources for the National Mining Association Industry Group, Dennis O'Dell, Safety Administrator for the United Mine Workers of America, and from WXXI in Rochester, New York, Ellen Smith, who is the managing editor of Mine Safety and Health News. Dennis O'Dell, over to you. And I should tell you, by the way, we're getting a lot of emails already. People are very involved in this story and in the culture of mining in this country. Mm-hmm. In a little while, we'll open up our phone lines if you want to join us with a question for our panel. The number is 1-800-433-8850. Before the break, Dennis, Gardner said something very provocative, which is that the workers themselves and the culture of mining actually may be a factor in the unsafe conditions in these mines. Your response?
Yeah, we've made the argument all along that you have reputable operators out there who are doing the right thing. They take safety as a high priority, and they work with their employees. And we seem to think that at Union Mines that works well. We've developed a working relationship with the operators to make those mines safer, because we educate our individuals on the laws, and they know they have rights and protections under the contract as to what they can do as far as protecting their health and safety. We also know that there's bad operators out there whose priority is production and not safety. And the point that needs to be made is it's not that the employees aren't afraid that the mine will shut down. They're afraid because of the intimidation factor that they'll be fired. And in this economy that we're faced with today, jobs are hard to find, and these guys have families and everything else, and they're afraid if they open their mouth, they'll be discharged, fired, and blackballed from the industry.
If they open their mouth, if they think that they, what you're saying is if they open their mouth because there's an unsafe situation, they're afraid they're going to lose their jobs.
They'll be fired. And
so they don't. And the unsafe conditions continue? That's what you're saying?
Unfortunately.
And Frank, understand what blackballed means. You know, in Appalachia, this is a series of small towns. Everybody knows everybody. And if you are known as a complainer in a mine, if you sort of are seen as somebody who talks about unsafe conditions, who doesn't help production, you're not only going to get fired from that mine, but you are never going to get a job in another nearby mine your entire career.
Bruce Watzman, point of view from the association, well, of the industry?
I just want to add one fact, and it's a stat that needs to be kept in mind. 86% of the mines in this country worked last year without a lost time accident. They're safe mines. They're doing the right thing. 86% of the mines in the country are not union mines. You know, it's not a union, non-union culture. That's where I take issue. You know, I think that operators know how to do the job, and it's proven by the declining number of injuries we're experiencing.
But Bruce and I have had this argument before, this debate, at those operations because of the intimidation factor. These guys are working injured. They're not reporting their injuries. They're not reporting the accidents. So, therefore, you're not really getting a true evaluation of what's going on out there.
Bruce, let me just ask you the question. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Alan.
No. There's one thing that I'd like to come back to on your first question before the break about the violations and how are these mine operators allowed to continue to operate.
Yeah.
And one point that the audience really needs to understand is the operator still has to correct the problem. The operator can contest the citation, mm-hmm. but it still has to correct that problem, and it has to do so in a timely fashion, and that's generally within a day or two, or, you know, immediately. The violations aren't allowed to continue, so even if the operator wants to disagree that the operator doesn't believe there was a violation, you still have to correct it to MSHA's standards, and the audience needs to understand that.
We're hearing from the union with, I can see you
yes.
nodding your head no.
Well, yeah.
Shaking your head no.
A lot of times, it isn't corrected immediately. The inspectors will give a certain amount of time because, unfortunately, the enforcement is not the same across the board. So you may have an inspector give somebody a longer amount of time to correct that violation that they find, number one. Number two, because of this huge backlog of contested cases, that's also a factor that has hurt that operator can continue to create the same violation, create it, keep doing it, because it may be years before it's even heard before an ALJ or the review commission.
This company, you know, appealed nearly all of its very significant violations last year.
What Ellen is saying is while it's appealing, it's supposed to fix them.
Right, but it also means that MSHA cannot do some of these
MSHA
patterns.
MSHA being Mine Safety and Health
The Mine Safety and Health Administration cannot do some of these very hard enforcement actions like a pattern of violations. You know, some of these to shut down the mine because it has continuing violations going on and on. As long as they appeal those violations, some of those very tough sanctions that federal regulators can bring cannot be brought
Ellen,
to bear.
Ellen, let me ask you one quick question, and then Bruce,
sure.
I'll come over to you. Are union mines safer than non-union mines, based on your research and work?
Well, I have to say that the union miners are certainly more vocal. There's no doubt. They are not afraid to speak out, you know, and
non-union
they'll tell you so.
And non-union
and
miners.
And non-union mines, you know. I get calls from sometimes non-union miners, and I hear that they don't want to give their name. They don't want to go to MSHA. They don't want to get their name out. And, you know, and I recognize
Bruce,
in fact, that the union miners tend to be more vocal about some issues.
Bruce, was this mine involved in this disaster more dangerous because it was a non-union mine?
I don't think so. And I think you need to look at the performance of the overall company.
The performance of the overall company is that Massey Energy racked up millions of dollars in penalties in recent years. Is that the performance you want to look at?
Well, Massey racked up $1 million of penalties, but they're not the only one that racked up $1 million of penalty. and that's a factor of changes in the civil penalty regulations that were made by the previous administration, where the fines, and we predicted that this outcome unfortunately would happen. They changed the rules in 2006 on how they calculate fines, and then the fines went up by several magnitudes. The similar conditions that would have been cited in 2006 at $600 or $700 or maybe $300 are now thousands of dollars or tens of thousands for the exact same condition. So it's understandable that the fines increased as they did.
Email from a listener on mine safety is the subject here. It's time Congress passed legislation with teeth giving every worker the right to join a union. Gardner, what's in front of Congress?
Well, you know, the UMWA membership has been declining for decades and decades, and although I value Dennis O'Dell here, I don't think having the union as sort of the coverall for all of mines is going to happen. I lived in Eastern Kentucky for a long time, and very few, if any, of those mines there are unionized. I mean, I think that there has to be a change. They're already considering legislation, but also there needs to be just a basic cultural change, I think, in these towns that just have to sort of say, we're not going to put up with this anymore.
Let's come back to this particular mine and this particular crisis that we are confronting right now, this disaster. Here's another email from Andrea, who asks, would you please explain why the vent holes are not standard operating procedure for methane in mines known to release methane? I mean, she writes, before people are killed. Dennis?
Well, they are. Mines have to be able to ventilate the methane outside through bleeder fans, or a lot of companies, what they'll do is they'll actually degas the mine before production occurs, they'll capture that. We have some operators out there capturing methane and making more money off the methane than they are the coal. But the key is to have a good ventilation system set in place at the mine that effectively removes that, and that may not have been the case.
Bruce, explain how methane either builds up or is vented to either prevent or cause a disaster like this.
Well, methane is liberated when the coal is cut. It's inherent in some coal seams, and when the coal is fractured, the methane is released. Dennis is exactly right. There are huge fan installations on the surface of mines. Thousands of cubic feet of fresh air are normally moved through the mines. They move across the area where the coal is being extracted, and then that air is removed from the mines. That's the principal way. Some mines do capture the methane gas because it is natural gas. It is a marketable commodity.
This sounds like a huge explosion at this mine, so this suggests that this gas built up way past safe levels, obviously.
More than that.
It's not just the gas. You know, so methane is basically like the carbonation in club soda. You know, it remains in the coal while pressure is on the coal. And then when you relieve the pressure from the coal, then it starts bubbling out, just like the bubbles in carbonated soda. And so they set up these very elaborate venting mechanisms. But in an explosion, of course, that sort of elaborate ductwork and everything else gets blown to smithereens. And the explosion in this mine seemed so powerful that it's likely that it wasn't just methane that added to this mine, but rather coal dust itself is actually even more explosive. And this mine had repeated problems with failing to control coal dust.
So you had a witch's brew down there.
Exactly.
Hey, let me tell you, I worked underground for 20 years, ran a miner, worked on a longwall, have seen phase ignitions occur. I've ran a miner when we've had phase ignitions. So you're exactly right. Methane, it's more than just a factor of methane, because methane, if there's nothing for it to catch on to, it'll burn itself out. But everything that we've heard at this coal mine, as far as a magnitude of this type of explosion, there had to be coal float dust involved. There's no question in my mind. People can speculate, but I'm telling you, my experience as a coal miner and the job I'm in now, there had to be an excessive amount of coal.
Dennis, before I go on, and I want to come back to Alan to ask about this explosion and similarities to another one a few years ago, I just want to ask you on a personal level, as a guy who's been deep underground and who's run this equipment and who knows people who come and go, when you hear about something like this, what does that do to you?
Well, it makes you sick at your stomach. That's your first reaction, because you know, it could be one of your friends, it could be one of your family members, and in a position where I'm at now, it makes me wonder, you know, what could we have done to help prevent this? What what steps could have been taken, number one. And then after you get that over that gut wrenching, that sickness in your stomach, then you get mad. You get mad, and you want to do something about it and make some changes. So there's a lot of emotions that run through you.
Alan, are there similarities between what may have happened at the Upper Big Branch mine, this one, and the accident at the Aracoma mine in 2006, about 4 years ago?
Well, I mean, at the Aracoma mine, all the unwarrantable failure violations were found after the accident, and it certainly put a huge spotlight on MSHA and the failure of some inspectors, because that mine was also inspected quite frequently before the Aracoma fire happened. And you know, in this case, we've got the unwarrantable failure violations we know about. I mean, they're not finding them after the fact. We know that there were quite a few.
But, I mean, Ellen, tell Frank a little bit about that mine, because that mine, the mine operator in that mine deliberately created conditions that were unsafe for the miners. I mean,
right. At Aracoma.
What do you mean deliberately created? Explain
that,
Ellen.
Well, they didn't have the adequate water pressure in the water lines to put out the fires. They didn't have the proper firefighting equipment underground. I mean, there were just massive amounts of violations that had been ongoing. And that was just the amazing story behind Aracoma, is I was reading about these violations and going, how in the world were these allowed to continue?
And they knew that the ventilation in that mine was not up to standard. They knew it beforehand.
Right. Folks, I just want to remind the audience briefly. I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to call us, join us, please call us at 1-800-433-8850, or you can send an email to us at drshow@wamu.org. We're going to move to the phones in just a minute. But, Bruce, I want to give you a chance to talk from the industry's point of view about the conversation that Gardner and Ellen were just leading, that is to say, deliberate violations. Why shouldn't Americans, who get half of their electricity from coal, in a country where coal is part of our culture — we don't often talk about it, we tend to talk about it around times of disaster, but it is a part of our lore across the country, right? — why shouldn't people be outraged when they hear allegations such as this attached to a disaster such as the one we're witnessing now?
Well, this is a behavior that should be unacceptable to everyone. You know, we're in a day and a time and a place when we know how to do the right things as an industry, and we're proving year after year with the improving safety records that we're able to do the right thing. You know, you touched upon it early in the show. Fatalities continue to decrease in the industry. Each fatality is tragic in and of itself, this one especially. You know, since 1970, coal production has increased 76%, fatalities have decreased 73%. Similarly, injuries in the industry are declining. So we're on the right track as an industry. We'll learn from this. We learn from each of these, unfortunately. We'd like to learn by a different means, and we'll do better.
Will the United Mine Workers of America, Dennis, at least grant that much, that as coal production has increased, the danger, in some sense, has decreased?
Like I said earlier, you have reputable operators that do the right thing as far as health and safety goes. I believe that. But you have too many operators out there who still break the law. We need to do much better in policing these coal mines to make sure that the health and safety of these miners is granted. And I'm going to tell you something. I don't care what anybody says, as long as the mentality out there is like it is today. And by the way, nobody talks about the black lung issues. We still have a huge problem with black lung issues. And where are they at? They're in those hot spots that we've recently located, those hot spots in those non-union coal mine fields.
And there's another pressure point on the industry, which we haven't talked about, and that's the whole question of the environmental impact and climate change.
Well,
and what role it should be playing there. But without making this a big — you know, we're talking about something that's happening in real time.
No, but I mean, safety — his point about black lung is a really good one, because it goes to safety in the mines. It's not just about roof falls and explosions. It's also that 1,500 miners die every year from black lung, a disease that we've known how to solve and prevent for 50 years.
Ellen Smith, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the keys that I've been focusing on sort of in life and through my newsletter is, you know, better educating miners. I tell mine operators, take these stories I write, copy them, give them to your workforce. I think that if we better educate the miners into everything, you know, why you need dust controls. You know, you just not respirable dust, but explosive dust levels. You don't want black lung. You don't want silicosis. You don't want mine explosions. And I think if we can better educate our miners, that will also help in safety issues.
But it doesn't matter if you educate. You can educate miners all you want to, but until you assure them that they have a voice in the workplace, that they can express that, it's not going to matter.
Bruce, I want to bring your voice in here and the voice of the industry. If you had an opportunity right now to talk about this disaster with Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey, what would you tell him?
Well, I don't know if I'd tell him anything because I don't think we know enough right now, quite honestly. And that's what the investigation is going to tell all of us. MSHA, the state, outside parties are going to do an exhaustive investigation to determine why this event occurred. And his company will learn, and we'll all learn.
A brief break now. When we come back, your calls for our panel and our experts on the subject of coal mine safety and what's happening at the Upper Big Branch mine. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org, and by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
Getting to know the neighbors, one sleepover at a time. One journalist's quest to meet and connect with the other people on his suburban street by spending days and nights with them. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Our topic, the Upper Big Branch mine, the disaster that's playing out in front of our very eyes at this time, and the culture of mining and dangers associated with it across the United States. Want to go now for questions to our panel, to the phones, our panel being Gardner Harris, science reporter for the New York Times, Dennis O'Dell, safety administrator for the United Mine Workers Union, Ellen Smith, managing editor of Mine Safety and Health News. She joins us from WXXI Studios in Rochester, New York, and Bruce Watzman, he's the vice president for Health and Human Resources at the National Mining Association. To the phones now, and Erica, who joins us from Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Erica. Thanks for being so patient and standing by. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Whether it's mining companies like Massey or many other industries, the Bush administration had an abysmal record on enforcing safety or pollution regulations on corporations. The Bush policy was to let these corporations police themselves and not be accountable to government rules. In turn, the corporate spokespeople would try to intimidate by saying regulations would hurt job growth for the American people. Will we see a difference in the Obama administration with regard to more regulations and more enforcement on corporate interests, who have held us hostage, I believe, for too many years?
Okay, Erica, thanks for your question. Let me go to the reporter in the room, Gardner.
Well, I think like a lot of things in the Bush administration, there was a distinct difference between the first term of the Bush administration and the second term. This was true in foreign policy. This actually was also true in occupational safety and health stuff. So in the first Bush administration, Dennis can talk a lot about this, but, you know, they really believed in not fining operators, but trying to educate operators. And in fact, they sort of wanted to call inspectors something other than inspectors, but rather sort of, what was it? What was the term that they wanted to use again?
Compliance officers.
Compliance officers. That's right. So instead of sort of coming in with fines and things like that, they really wanted to just have them talk to them. By the second Bush administration, after there was, you know, a real spike in fatalities after Sago, they really retreated on a lot of this stuff. And in fact, the Miner Act of 2006, as Bruce has discussed, increased penalties. And I think the Bush administration realized they'd made a mistake.
Bruce, where is this administration going with regulation?
Well, it's hard to say. It's early in the administration. But clearly across the board, this administration has a different view of the coal industry as a whole. While they talk about coal on the one hand and the importance of coal, we've seen repeated initiatives and policies come out of the administration that really raises questions in our mind as to what type of commitment they have to coal as a fuel source to continue to power our country.
Well, you're back to the energy and climate issue.
That's
and how
right.
That overlaps with the safety and productivity issues. Back to the phones. Nick from Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Good morning to all of you. I just wanted to make a comment on one of the statistics cited by one of your panelists stating that 86% of the mines in this country operate safely. Well, let's turn that on its head. If that's the implication is that 14% of the mines in this country do not operate safely, or at least with some violations, don't know the severity of the violations, but they still operate unsafely. If in any other industry, if we had that kind of statistic, people would be outraged. And I just want to know, is there something that I'm missing? Is this supposed to be a good number somehow?
Bruce,
I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks so much. Bruce, that was your statistic. You can respond.
It was my statistics. And the 86% has to do with the number of mines operating without a lost time injury. Is that good enough? Absolutely not. Lost time injury can be anything from seriously being hurt. A fatality is classified as a lost time injury. So is someone who has a cut that requires sutures. So there's the great range. But, you know, it was to show that we are doing better. We have more room to grow and to better perform.
Ellen, you track this stuff. What do you make of that statistic? Is that a statistic to brag about, or as the caller suggests, it's actually still way out of bounds?
Well, like I like to point out to people all the time, farming is far more dangerous. Our agricultural industry is far more dangerous than mining. I'm not saying that mining isn't dangerous. It is, and that's why it is so heavily regulated, and you need to follow the rules. One of the other points, and I agree with Bruce. The problem is when I look at accident statistics, and every time I write about a mine, I always look at their history. And the bottom line is, if there's something that requires sutures or somebody twisted an ankle and they're out of work for a couple of days, or they twisted their knee coming off of a ladder, I just don't count that. It's counted in the non-fatal days lost. It's counted as an accident. But, you know, I view that very differently than a hunk of roof that has come off and hit somebody in the shoulder. And so you have to really look at every single citation and accident. You can't sort of make these broad statements.
Well, let me pursue that with Dennis, courtesy of a comment posted by Stephen, who says, when my father was in the mining business 60 years ago in Pennsylvania, they always knew — always is all capitals here — they always knew in advance when the inspectors were to arrive. It wasn't random. And he says, I doubt it's been changed today. This gave them time to correct the most serious problems. That still exists?
It's still a problem today.
Well, not only that.
Absolutely. Not only is it a problem, but it's become more of a problem because now we have tracking devices in the mines. So an operator can sit outside and track where that inspector is going and call ahead of time and tell them, you know, what part of the mine they're going to inspect. So although we've had a new regulation put in place to track miners to try to make it better, there's a downside to it because it could give advance notice of where that inspector
is. Are you saying this whole system is corrupt? I mean, what are we saying here?
Yes. You know, look, first of all, Frank, when an inspector shows up at the mine, and I've known dozens of inspectors, they will tell you that the first thing that happens when they show up is that coal stops coming off the belt coming out of the mine. And what that tells them is that the miners down in the mine are no longer mining coal. What they're doing is cleaning the thing up. And I have known dozens, scores, I've known hundreds of miners from living amongst them. And it is very difficult to find a miner, particularly in the non-union areas of eastern Kentucky, who will tell you that these mines are run anywhere close to what the standard of law requires them to be run.
Bruce Watzman.
I can't sit here idly by and let Gardner indict an entire industry. I mean, he's indicting the mine operators, the miners, the federal inspectors, the state inspectors at this point.
I'm not saying that the inspectors are corrupt. I'm just saying when they show up, it will take them. A mine is often a mile and 2 miles deep. It can take an inspector how long, Dennis? About a half hour, 45 minutes, if they get the man trip to the inspector immediately, which they often don't. So the coal miners can have as long as an hour, two hours, even on a surprise inspection, to clean things up before the inspector actually shows up.
Okay, I've got to step in here.
I do it briefly because I want to get back to the phones.
Yeah, we do hear these stories, okay? You know, the inspectors come in quickly. They're going to put up ventilation curtains and things like that. But the whole system is not corrupt because if it was, we would not have the decrease in fatalities and accidents that we were just celebrating these records 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C. with Hilda Solis and Joe Maine and a room full of operators, attorneys, the UMWA. We have reached records as far as safety. And if the system was corrupt, we would not be able to reach those records.
Dennis O'Dell is sitting across from me wearing a shirt that has UMWA prominently on it. Will you agree with Ellen? You were in the room, or your union was?
It's a mixed bag. We still have some corruption out there that takes place, and let me tell you something. When I traveled with inspectors at the coal mine when I worked as a representative of the miners, we had good inspectors that would go in and get on the man trip and jump on the man trip and head to the section before anybody could do anything about it. So you have that that goes on. I can say at our union operations, I don't know what goes on at these non-union operations.
Let's go back to the phones. Tom from Ellicott City, Maryland, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call. I am a director of photography freelancer and had the opportunity to work on a film on a father and son coal miner down in southwestern Virginia over a four-year period. The film is titled Bone Crusher, and that was the father's underground nickname. And during the time that we filmed with the two of them, I had the opportunity to go underground with Lucas Chasen, who was the son, who's still a young coal miner down there in the Dant, Virginia area. And myself and director Mike Fountain spent a day with him in a very small non-union mine. And one thing that I have a story to share is that regarding the use of the respirators, and that was that we were given respirators, of course, and all the miners had them. But part of the problem with them seemed to be that they're cumbersome, you're sweaty working down there, they bother you, you can't communicate, not that there's much opportunity for communication because usually they're working large pieces of equipment. But most of the men for sure did not wear them, even though we were always told by folks, oh yes, I wear my respirator. And I was operating a camera, and it was very difficult to attempt to operate the camera to get close to the eyepiece to film, so I didn't wear my respirator either. But the director, Mike, wore his, and when he would try to communicate with the miners and talk to them, they would joke with him and tell him to take his panties off. And I thought that says a lot about it.
So you're saying the culture was not to wear respirators and not to perhaps comply with some of the regulations that the workers should have been complying with? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think it was like an organized, intentional thing at all, but it's part of out of practicality and part of just, you know, the work experience down there.
Okay. Dennis, what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, if you were in a coal mine where you had to wear a respirator the entire time you were there, then they had a serious problem with the dust. Because I can tell you that the reputable operators that I keep going back to provide enough air to let our miners work in a clean, you know, fairly clean atmosphere. They use good engineering controls, whether it be wind, water, what have you, to help control that dust. But if you were in a coal mine and you had to wear that respirator the entire time, and I'm not saying like guys that were, like when I ran a shear or when I ran a miner or bolted off the side of a miner, I'd wear a respirator. And then when I was out by, maybe running a shuttle car or doing some other jobs, there were times I didn't need it. So, you know, you just got to look at the situation.
Alan, an email from Carol who emails us the following. I'm appalled that some of your guests are blaming the victims, i.e. the miners. Having lived in Appalachia and studied the mining industry, I believe the first thing we must recognize is that both the coal industry and the government in West Virginia have systematically destroyed unions and prevented other industries from coming into West Virginia, thus totally constricting job choices. Your response?
I don't think anyone is blaming the victims. I mean, you know, what I'm saying is I'd like to see a better educated miner.
Gardner just across the table from me said, I just sort of, I lip-synced. I think I just did.
Yeah, I mean, I think I did. And that comes from years of living amongst them and feeling frustrated that these things continue to go on.
But you don't think that these poor people have lost their lives at the Big Branch mine are themselves responsible for what just happened?
No, I don't. But I'm talking about this culture of mining where people allow, and you know, Ellen is right. Most of the mine industry has really cleaned up its act. And certainly even West Virginia, although this took place in West Virginia is generally better than Eastern Kentucky, where there are mostly small non-union mines.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have a few minutes left on this topic of mine safety in the Upper Big Branch mine, where the current disaster is unfolding. If you'd like to join us, you can call us at 1-800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. We'll go back to the phones in just a minute.
But let me explain. I mean, I think quickly that there is an Appalachian culture of valuing place. You know, what is in these people's blood is a love of their home place and of their people, and that keeps them there. And with few opportunities, it makes them an easy target for exploitation in these very small mines that often, I think, do run poorly.
Well, I think Gardner, I'm glad he admitted that to some degree he did blame the victims, and that was unfortunate, and that's what I took issue with. There is a culture down there. There's a culture of God. There's a culture of family. There's a culture of community. There are high values down there. There are other opportunities, and, you know, people are looking to build on those opportunities.
Tom is on the phone with us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Tom. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hi, Frank. How are you this morning?
I'm just great. Thanks for calling.
Frank, my question is this. If these operators of these coal mines intentionally avoid practices that would save the lives of these miners, and they know that. They do this intentionally. And then we have miners who die in the mines. Why are these people not charged with negligent homicide?
Well, let me direct that question to the man from the industry, Bruce Motzman. Why not?
Well, there are criminal sanctions that can be cited under the Mine Act, and in fact, there have been criminal prosecutions in the past. You know, we have yet to know, and the assumption of the caller's question is that this was intentional behavior on the part of the operator. We don't know that yet. We don't know what occurred there yet. That's what the investigation will tell us. And then if it was intentional on the part of anyone, the law provides the government all the tools they need to take the actions that they feel are appropriate.
Dennis, as we wrap these comments up now, as we see what's going to take place over the next several days, weeks, and months as the investigation proceeds, what will people be looking for most from within the industry?
They're going to be looking to see what happened. You know, why this could possibly, right now we know it's the worst disaster since 1984. And if the four individuals in the mine aren't brought out safely, we could go back to 1970, right about the same time that the act was brought into the place. So everybody's going to be looking to see where this investigation takes us. Now, let me tell you something, if I can, real quick. The act states the most precious resource of any coal mine is the miner. And if operators truly believe that, and if they believe safety is their priority, and if they believe that workers should have a voice at their work and not be afraid to say something, why do they spend all this money to keep them and intimidate them from allowing a union to come in? And they do that. Bring it to a point because
on the criminal thing
speak.
Also, on the criminal thing, the Mine Act actually was this. It does not give MSHA criminal powers. MSHA does not have criminal investigators. If MSHA finds, which is the Mine Safety and Health Administration, if they find some criminal something, they have to refer to the FBI. So there is a very high bar for them.
Closing thought, Bruce, very quickly.
Well, we're going to learn from this. We're going to do better from this. We're doing better since 2006 in SEGO. We've introduced new technologies. This investigation will tell us whether we have to change the law, change the regulations. What we need are good answers, not quick answers.
And I need a quick answer. I'm sorry about that, Ellen, from you, because we only have about 20 seconds, but a final thought.
My final thought is, you know, we don't know what happened in this accident. And yes, this mine operator had a lot of violations. But take a look at SEGO. That explosion was caused by a lightning strike. Nobody ever thought that that's what the explosion was caused from. So we really have to wait and let the investigators do their job before we have answers.
And we're going to have to leave it there. And, of course, our thoughts with the families and the miners themselves who are going through this terrible tragedy. You've been listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've been talking about the life and the safety and the perils underground and at the Upper Big Branch Mine. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again soon.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.